The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the guests and not necessarily those of KICI Radio or Extend the Dream Foundation.
Hello and welcome to the Situation Room. In this program, KICI takes a look at issues affecting our community, local government, health, the environment, economics, services, nonprofits and organizations, and more. Segments are broadcast throughout the week and also on our SoundCloud site and Facebook page. Not a few days go by, it seems, without some groundbreaking or shocking news. This would include two recent decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court. First, the June 24th decision on Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, which effectively overturned Roe v. Wade. That had provided a federal guarantee of privacy involving legal access to abortion. That was followed by the June 30th decision on West Virginia v. the Environmental Protection Agency, which limits the EPA's authority to curb power plant carbon emissions. Then, comments from Justice Clarence Thomas indicated that more decisions that similarly limit federal government's oversight could be in the offing. Oversight of civil liberties, the environment, and other areas of the law would be turned over to the states. Here to comment today, we once again welcome Professor Nicholas Johnson, recently retired from teaching law at the University of Iowa. Nicholas Johnson was a federal communications commissioner in the Lyndon B. Johnson administration, and, perhaps especially relevant to this talk, he served as clerk to Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black, 1959 to 1960. Nicholas Johnson, thank you for joining us again today.
Well, thank you. You've laid out quite an agenda for us today, Holly.
Our talk today stems from two articles Nicholas Johnson recently had published in the Gazette, Arc of Justice and The Day Democracy Died, Arc of Justice dealing with the Supreme Court decision on Roe versus Wade. To start with, why don't you explain just what was involved in that decision and the trend the Supreme Court seems to be following at this time?
Sure. The sad thing goes well beyond any given decision. And that is that the Supreme Court, unlike the Congress and the executive, really has no power to enforce its decisions. Its power comes from the trust that the American people have in the court and the respect for the justices and a sense that they operate outside the political realm. They're a non-political branch. Well, there have certainly been some interesting and distressing opinions coming out of this court, but I think in many ways, even more significant and dreadful than the results in these cases, is what it has done to the Supreme Court as an institution, and a very important one in our democracy, because this is the way we resolve disputes when there's no other way to resolve them. We have a group of nine people who are qualified as lawyers who need to be perceived by the public as totally non-political in what they do, reading the law and applying it the way that they understand it, so that when we have disputes, say when I was there, for example, who got how much of the water in the Colorado River between two states, there is no way to resolve a dispute like that if people can't agree and we don't want violence to be used to decide it. And so we have this thing called the Supreme Court of the United States, where you can bring a dispute like that. And the court comes up with a decision, and everybody accepts it. They agree ahead of time to accept it, in effect. And it permits the society to go on without violent resolution of disputes. But that requires that the Supreme Court be as appearing to be a totally non-political institution. And take the matter of the Roe v. Wade case. That decision and what I describe as the sails of the abortion debate are driven by the winds of religion and politics. The anti-abortion stance has been that of the Catholic Church, both before and after Roe, and the Republican Party has had this as one of their platform planks for decades. And six of the seven Catholic justices out of nine justices, were appointed by Republican presidents George W. Bush and Donald Trump. So you have a commonality of church and religious doctrine and political doctrine from one party that are really driving this. And that makes it very much more difficult for the public at large. The Supreme Court comes by the respect that it has with some almost mythology. They wear black robes. When they enter the court, they come from behind a curtain. They do their work behind locked gates on the corridor around their offices. And until the totally unprecedented leak from the court this year, they work in great mystery, and they have their secret meeting amongst only the justices, where the junior justice has to come and open the door if somebody's ordered coffee or whatever. And no leaks from the court until finally they come out from behind the curtain again in their black robes and settle down, and someone announces the decision of the court that they've come to. Well, it really appeared in this instance, including the leak of an opinion that was very close to the final opinion that they issued, that this really was a religious and a political decision, much more than it was a legal decision. And furthermore, some of the justices who voted to overturn Roe during their Senate hearings had proclaimed when asked that Roe was settled law, and represented that to senators. And then they went and did it. It has led to essentially the destruction of the Supreme Court as an institution, no longer able to perform the functions the founders had for it, because it's become political and it's no longer respected as a court. And that's a very dangerous blow to our democracy. Now, you mentioned Justice Thomas, and there's something very interesting about him. The majority said, oh, the rationale we used to decide this case, that's just limited to this case. Well, we're not going to use that rationale in the future, even though Alito had already used it in his dissent in the gay marriage case. I don't know how he explains that. And then Justice Thomas went on to identify some areas. The rationale was that unless something is specifically mentioned in the Constitution, it's not a constitutional right. What the court in Roe did was to look at all the other ways in which personal rights were preserved and say, look, a part of what we're talking about here is privacy, the Fourth Amendment protecting searches and seizures of one's persons, houses, papers, and effects. A case came up for the first time whether or not tapping a telephone wire and you're not on the person's property, does that violate the Fourth Amendment? And the first time, the court said, well, no, there's nothing in the Fourth Amendment about tapping telephone wires. And then the next time up, they said, well, no, what they're really talking about is the privacy of a person that needs to be protected, and that they couldn't talk about telephones because they didn't exist when they wrote it. So the Supreme Court has been finding this right of privacy in cases involving same-sex activity, gay marriage. In the Griswold case, the purchase of contraceptives, which had been outlawed in the state. And they said no, that there's a right of privacy that prohibits the state from banning the sale of contraceptives. And Justice Thomas laid out those three examples. What is very interesting is that there is a fourth example, which is really kind of prominent in his opinion because it's not mentioned. And that is the case of Loving versus Virginia, which involved a ban on marriage between African Americans and whites. And Loving versus Virginia said that that involved this privacy right and that the law was unconstitutional, that a state cannot ban a marriage between blacks and whites just on the basis of skin color. Now, why is that of interest with regard to Justice Thomas? Because Justice Thomas, an African American, has a white wife. So it seems a little ironic or hypocritical or something that he would designate these cases where the rationale could be applied, but didn't think to mention one that would have involved him. So that's more than enough on that, I think.
You had mentioned also you had some thoughts on the more recent ruling on the Environmental Protection Agency.
Well, yes, and with regard to that, my credentials include not only what you mentioned, but my first teaching job at the Law School of the University of California, Berkeley. I was an administrative law professor and wrote about administrative law issues and taught about them. And then at the FCC, I was a member as commissioner of an administrative agency, which had been created by Congress, very similar to the EPA, in that it was an agency created by Congress, and one in which the matter of congressional delegation of powers came up in the 1940s in an opinion by Justice Frankfurter, which looked at the delegation from Congress to the FCC. And the standard for granting and renewing licenses, as you know, that the standard is public interest, that the FCC should decide to grant or not grant and renew licenses to broadcast based on a standard whether the public interest will be served. Well, NBC thought that was a little vague, that Congress had just kind of turned the whole thing over to this agency. And Justice Frankfurter said, no, that the Congress wanted to do that, and they provided this public interest standard, and that's enough. So the interesting thing about this in terms of the Supreme Court's review is that there are things the court agrees really belong elsewhere. They had a category called political decisions, and they would say, well, this is nothing that the court has the knowledge or the grant of power or the ability to address. This is something that has to be resolved politically. So what most courts have done since the Roosevelt administrative agency creation, sometimes called the administrative state, kind of the fourth branch of government, is that Congress, for a variety of reasons, cannot get into the weeds and the details on everything that the government interacts with. They don't have the knowledge, as indeed the Supreme Court justices don't have the knowledge to be making environmental protection decisions of incredible specificity that they got into in this case. I mean, it's almost laughable when you read through the opinion. So they don't have the knowledge to make the decisions that need to be made. They don't have the time to do it because that's a very time-consuming process is carried out by the agencies. And they don't have the flexibility to make prompt changes when they're called for. So the only practical way to do all that the federal government does is for Congress to provide some broad outlines, create the agency, provide some broad outlines as to what their responsibilities are to be, and then delegate to the agencies the ability to make those decisions. And so the court came up with this never before heard of doctrine called the Major Question Doctrine. Dissenting Justice Kagan had a little fun with that because it had never been heard of before. She did a masterful job. I'm going to write her a letter and thank her for that opinion because as somebody who still has an interest in administrative law, I just thought it was an incredibly powerful and well-written analysis. I'm going to quote a couple brief paragraphs from that. Her opinion is as long as the majorities and the concurring opinions are. She really got into it. But at the beginning of her opinion, she says, a key reason Congress makes broad delegations like Section 111 is so an agency can respond appropriately to new and big problems. Congress knows what it doesn't know and can't know when it drafts a statute. And Congress, therefore, gives an expert agency the power to address issues, even significant ones, as and when they arise. And that is what Congress did in enacting Section 111. And then for her near concluding, I guess it's a concluding paragraph, she says, the stakes here are high, yet the court today prevents congressionally authorized agency action to curb power plants' carbon dioxide emissions. The court appoints itself instead of Congress or instead of the expert agency, the decision maker on climate policy. The court appoints itself the decision maker on climate policy. I cannot think of many things more frightening. Respectfully, I dissent. What this is about, business does not like to be regulated. I guess none of us really like to be regulated in the family or workplace or anywhere else. But business can be very abusive in a variety of ways and act in ways that are contrary to the best interests of the nation as a whole. Congress was set up by the founders as a way of providing some restraints on the worst abuses. Business has long attacked the regulations coming out of these agencies. And so what the court is doing is giving large corporations essentially a base on balls. If they don't like a regulation that the agency regulating them has come out with, they just shout, Major Question Doctrine, and the Supreme Court will overturn the agency. Well, I think this is kind of like the Political Question Doctrine, where the court says, you know, we're not a political body, we don't have the wisdom, or we don't have the grant of power to be deciding cases like this. I think that's the position they ought to take with regard to this relationship between Congress and the agencies. Congress wrote the law the way they wrote it. Congress can amend the law, repeal the law, extend the law in any way they want. They call the agency before congressional committees, the Substantive Committee and the Budget Committee for that agency. That's an opportunity to review what the agency is doing. They can pick up the phone and call an FCC commissioner. They can write letters. They can make speeches. They can make their will known to the agency, and they do. So I think this is a system where the court almost all the time ought to stay out of it entirely and let Congress write the laws. And let the Congress delegate to agencies what they feel they must delegate because they don't have the knowledge, they don't have the time, and they can't keep up with the necessary changes. And then if they don't like it, they can change the delegation business later. So that's my take on the EPA case.
Well, it's clear right now that the court has apparently won out in terms of how this law or how these policies are to be governed, and that decisions will be made now by the individual states. Or, as I'm guessing, there's probably going to be a lot of confusion, lawsuits. My question to you is, at least for now, what you think might be the best way to address this? Because right now it's state, municipal governments that are going to have to be dealing with these issues. There are some efforts to enact congressional legislation to deal with these issues. What ideas do you have as to how we can best go about addressing these concerns? You say the court has been politicized, certain federal oversight has now been overruled. I'm sure some people would say this is a great opportunity, or maybe this is not a bad thing, but I think many people are concerned about both Roe v. Wade and the EPA decisions. What ideas do you have in terms of addressing these issues?
Let me just take the abortion issue. I think the situation with the law now is such a disaster for everybody. The primary impact of it is going to be on the poor, minorities, immigrants. And on the one hand, it has that impact on them. And on the other hand, at the other end of the economic ladder, up at the top, women who are used to buying $1,000 airline tickets and have no problem paying $500 a night hotel bills, so long as there are some states that permit abortions, are going to be at least very much less impacted by the decision than will others. Now, that's not totally true, because there are instances during a pregnancy when things are going wrong and a woman really needs to immediately go to a hospital and get hospitalization. And there may not be time to book a flight and set up something in a hospital in another state. But for others of her wealth, they are inconvenienced, they're out a little money. And so it becomes really a legal act of cruelty, I would say, that is going to lead to the death of mothers. The best you can say is that it's a life imprisonment penalty that's being imposed upon them if there are good and sufficient reasons why they do not wish to be pregnant and there's no way they can deal with the pregnancy, particularly if they succeed some way in prohibiting the delivery of the pill through the mail.
I know there are some efforts underway to have Congress address through specific legislation some of these decisions.
That's what I was going to say next. There are a couple things the individual can do or the Congress can do. I think abortion practices really require a national standard. And I know there are people, the Right to Life folks, who would like to have a law through Congress prohibiting abortions anywhere in the country. At least that would make the policy consistent. And there are others who would like to have an act of Congress proclaiming that no state can ban abortion and come up with some kind of standard. So I think we probably are going to end up with some national legislation, but that remains to be seen. Aside from that, I think there are many organizations and individuals, corporations who are announcing that they'll pay the airfare and hotel costs for any employee that needs to leave the state. And then I think vote are the three bits of advice I'd give. So you have people in your state legislatures and in Congress who support whatever your view is on the issue. So that's about it for now, I think, on that subject.
Well, thank you for your comments. We have been speaking today with Professor Nicholas Johnson, retired from teaching law at the University of Iowa, a federal communications commissioner under the Lyndon B. Johnson administration, and a clerk to Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black in 1959 and 1960. Nicholas Johnson has written a number of essays, op-eds, and books, and you can find more information about him and his writing online at nicholasjohnson.org and fromdctoiowa.blogspot.com. That's from DC, number 2, Iowa, www.blogspot.com. Nicholas Johnson, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much, Holly. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
You've been listening to The Situation Room. These segments are broadcast throughout the week, and we also upload them to our SoundCloud site and post the links and links to more resources on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/ICLocalRadio. Or in the Facebook search bar, enter KICI Iowa City Local Radio. If you have suggestions, questions, or information, email us at info@kiciradio.org. I'm Holly Hart for KICI LP 105.3 FM, Iowa City.